common denominator amongst the officers was a French officer to every team, and one either from the Americans or the British. These pairs were all put up on lists on the notice board, and all the operators were then requested to choose whichever pair that they would like to go into the field with. The thought being that as they were going to be the junior rank, it was better for them to choose a couple that they could get on with, and therefore the team would work more coherently, than if they were drafted into a pair and the others just pulled rank all the time and you would have umbrage taken. And that is, there was quite a lot behind the scenes where various pairs of officers getting hold of our instructors and who's the best operator and who just this and that. And a lot of buttering up, if you like, to try and get together. But we did all get together, and I got together with Major Sharp and Captain... Oh, good. And Captain Mutin of the French.
M-U-T-I-N?
Yes. Major Sharp was an I Corps major, and it turned out that he had many irons in the fire beside Jedburgh. We continued on our team training, physical fitness being one of the prime objects, weapons use being, of course, a good secondary one, demolition, of course, being another. And then we went and did our parachute jumps at Ringway, where we had American commando Greenberries training us for that. We did our four jumps. Mine, of course, had to be different from everybody else's. I did the last jump out of the plane of the day. I was told afterwards, a complete loop in the air. In other words, I was swung from the centre in a complete circle over the top of where I came out and down again. Then the chute Roman candled, and I thought I'd had it, and just closed my eyes and waited, and then that man prepared to land and realised it was me, and I prepared to land. I landed on the burning mattress they use for smoke to give direction of wind. Being the last man out, I missed my coffee. Back to base, and we were then going to do two night jumps in the balloons, and you went up in the balloons, and they told you, you went out, and when you hit the ground, you were to yell out the number you were jumped from 1 to 5. We went up to our 700 feet, and off we jumped. I was number 5, I yelled out number 5, and same time as number 1. My chute had collapsed in the air and then opened out again. Unfortunately, I'd landed right up to my waist in soft mud. So that was that. Anyway, that was parachuting. After that, we just did a little more training, waiting to go into the field. We went to London and got briefed. And because we were going into southern France, it was decided we would go via Algiers, the ergonomics of that were much simpler. We flew in a York aircraft, which was quite innovative at the time because Yorks were very new. We lost an engine halfway across the Bay of Biscay, so we, instead of going straight on to Algiers, we landed at Gibraltar and had an engine change. Then we went on to Algiers. We were rather a sorry crew in Algiers because when flying there, the pilot had circled Onan, and to give us a treat, as it was a very clear day, and he climbed up to 10,000 feet. And we all had our bottles of Scotch whisky in the racks, net racking above us, and everyone burst. And the smell in that cabin was something to be believed. At Algiers, all our gear for our team, of course, was all at the airport because we had been briefed. We just had our small packs ready for the off. As soon as we got there, we found our mission aborted. The DX had been compromised. And we spent a month in Algiers. And were briefed at least five more times on different DZs, and they all aborted before we could go in. In the middle of this, Captain Mutan, who had been promoted major by now, was fooling around with a dummy bazooka, and he fired it. The difference between a dummy and a drill round bazooka, I should say, is that a dummy has no warhead explosive but still has the firing charge. A drill round has no charges whatsoever. And it hit him, just missed his manhood, but quite seriously injured his leg. So he, of course, went to hospital, and our team was now down to Major Sharp and myself. I was getting into a bit of mischief at the time, and suddenly, one afternoon, Fanny Todd, Peg Todd, came tearing up in a jeep. "You and Hartley, get your bags. You're going in tonight." And
what was this mischief you were in?
Do you want to know?
Yes, please.
Right. When I got to our house in Algiers, our headquarters, if you like, I found all the southern section NCOs were in hospital with an unknown fever. And they'd all been sleeping, the common denominator had been sleeping in a large cellar under the house. So that had been quarantined, and I slept with the I Corps sergeant. I was the only NCO there at the time. And after 2 or 3 weeks, which time I found the French weren't so fond of the English as they'd made out in England, we had a new OC of the unit, and the younger French officer said, "Well, that's a nice room those two sergeants are in. We want it. Get them out." So the I Corps sergeant was a law unto himself, said, "Right, I'll go and sleep under canvas with the base radio operators." And they said, "Right, well, Ellis will go down to the cellar." And Ellis said, "He isn't going down into the cellar, period." And we had a real ding-dong. This was a Captain Whittaker, and ended up with me chasing him up the road, shooting with my 4.5 at his heels, which he didn't take kindly to. Anyway, Hartley and the others managed to pacify him, said, well, we'll be off into the field any second now, so you can... And I got a bed in the tents with the others then. That was happy enough. So there came this day, 2 or 3 days later, that Peg Togg came tearing in with a jeep and said, you're going into the field tonight. And Hartley said, no, we can't, we haven't been briefed. She said, bugger the briefing. She said, you're going in tonight. She said, that stupid bloke Whittaker has been down and the Provost Marshal is on his way up here with the MPs to arrest John for shooting at him, you see. So we...
Who was this lady?
Peg Todd, T-O-D-D. She's dead now, I'm afraid. She was middle-aged then. Beautiful girl. And when we got up to the road in her jeep and turned up to the airport, we could see the MPs coming up. Fortunately, they went to the camp. And we went on to the airport, and most of these women knew their way around well and truly. She knew the OC of the airport, and she told him. And he wouldn't let them on the site at first, and then, of course, the Provost Marshal insisted, so he had to. And I was passed around, like passing the parcel in a game, all round. Everybody on the airport was in on it until it was time for me to take off.
And who was Hartley?
Hartley is Major Sharp. Sorry. They've got him down listed as L.C. Sharp, but I don't know where that came from. Because his Christian name was Hartley. And so we took off across.
When was this?
Well, they say it was 14th of August, which was nonsense. It was somewhere about the 14th of July, I would suggest. And I can only work that out from the fact that going back to D-Day and then a few days briefing and then we were a month in Algiers.
So much for the written record being accurate then.
That's right. We jumped into France at a place called Bar de Seven.
Where's that?
That is in the Lower Pyrenees, just off to the side of the Rhone Valley. Unfortunately, the aircraft that we went into was a rather vintage Halifax that had had a engine put in the fuselage to drive all the auxiliaries, and it was very, very hot in there. And after we jumped, it was about 3 days later, I got a message back from Algiers. Can you please tell us anything about the state of the aircraft when it left you, because it hasn't returned? And it was believed to have exploded in mid-air, which I could well believe, because if you imagine a fuselage and this engine over one side really hot, immediately forward of that engine were all the fuel pipes across the fuselage from wing to wing with stopcocks. Highly dangerous thing. Can you turn that off a minute? Right. Due to all the heat in the fuselage and that going out, Hartley fell fast asleep, that's Major Sharp, And when we got to the DZ, he was quite a bit fuzzy, so we had to help him out through the hole. And but when I landed, it's marvellous what a drop by parachute will do. He was completely wide awake and chirpy, and greeted me, shake the hand, welcome to France, Johnny. And it wasn't until the unfortunate incident about 3 days later, when they inquired about our plane because it had failed to return, we subsequently found that it exploded in mid-air, that he asked how he actually jumped out the plane. And he had a few rude words to say to me on the subject.
What exactly happened when he went out?
Well, as he was so bemused, the dispatcher took one loop of his harness, and I took the other loop, and we just held him over the hole, and when the light turned green, we dropped him.
It's a rather risky thing to do, in a way.
Not really, no, because you were on the end of a static line, and that was it. I didn't think there was anything risky in it, to be honest.
I mean, he might not have pulled the ripcord.
There was no ripcord, you were on a static line. The chute opened automatically. Oh, no, if it had been a free-fall chute, no. As an aside on that, the OSS Americans had been trained with static chutes, but always carried a free-fall chute. And when they came to England and found that we didn't have any free-fall chutes, they were not very immured. But after they'd been trained and saw what happened up at Ringway, they wouldn't go back to the American way after.
What happened to you on the ground once you'd landed?
Once we landed at Barter 7, there was the welcoming committee, who must have been set up at the last moment, who greeted us and took us away to a genuine old French farmhouse, where you had all the stock in the centre of the floor, and you had curtained bunks all the way round where you slept, and the table to one side. They put us up there for the remainder of the night, and then the following day took me off to a small croft in the mountains, miles from anywhere, and Hartley off somewhere to, or Major Sharp, I must say, I suppose, Major Sharp off to organise things. It was rather weird because I spoke no French, in fact, still don't speak very much at all, and he, of course, was fluent. After a couple of days, during which time I needed the services of the local nurse with squitters, etc., after the raw milk and that I was getting, we then travelled overland to a place called Velarogue, which was across the mountains and down. Lower down in the Rhone Valley. Here, Major Sharp set up his headquarters with a Mackie, who were unique in as much they were led by a Protestant priest, for which we were very fortunate in as much that we had no Catholicism to dogmas to go against, and also they were not communists, so we didn't have the problems with the communists.
What was the priest's name?
I have no idea. I have none of their names at all. I did have all their names. I had it in a notebook, which I inadvertently left in a telephone booth when I returned back to England, and despite the fact I went to police and everywhere else, I never saw it again. It was most unfortunate. Hartley set up his headquarters at Villarogue with the Mackie. I went up to a place called Les Perreux, which was a mountain hotel area, just a small hotel for people who toured the Pyrenees, and to a group there who were receiving supplies in blind every week or something like that for them, Mackie and the region. The main reason was that up there I could get much better radio contact. It was there that I made my first radio contact, first of all with Algiers and then with London. I was working two-way gigs there. Later on it was intended I'd also work to Italy, but that didn't come about, thankfully, because I was doing at least 5 hours a day on the radio, plus doing all the coding and decoding. In the early days, it was most peculiar, because without the French officer, we were very much foreigners. Hartley Sharp was real Parisien, both in his manner and his speech, and this was greeted with quite a bit of suspicion by the southern, more or less working classes, the country people, and they didn't really want to do what he said, you know, they looked at that. And result was that he used to have to either phone me, or we had a messenger on a motorcycle, asking me to see the Mackie people and get them to do things like blowing a bridge or getting some supplies or something like that. And at times this was quite hilarious because, as I said, I spoke no French. They professed to know no English, which I found afterward was a little bit of a nonsense. And we were in that situation. But after a couple of successes, one was blowing a bridge and the other was getting some people transferred from somewhere, they took to Major Sharp just like that, and of course we had no more problems. I suppose we were there for about 10 days, and we then moved on. Incidentally, on the question of my being able to successfully operate on my radios, was the fact that when I got to Algiers, my customised Jed set, which I'd trained on all the time and got together, had been confiscated, and I was going to be given what they call a Mark 7, which was a bastardised B2 transmitter with a Jed receiver. Now this I'd also tried in England along with my comrades, and they were useless. It was a real useless thing. So I refused point blank to go into the field with this transceiver. Either I had my jet set or I wouldn't go, and requested return to London, especially as Captain Mutan later, you know, got his injury. They refused that, and then they talked around themselves, and the sergeant who was on their base radio there agreed that these sets weren't very good, so they compromised the end and let me have the old trusty B2 suitcase set, and from that I was able to do all my schedules without any fuss. In fact, I believe I was the only member that went in from Algiers that made contact. certainly several of my colleagues, when we met up later in Lyon, all borrowed it, put their crystals in, got through and got their closing down message, and that was the only time that they did anything. So that was a good thing. Well, from Les Perus, we then started to go towards civilization more. We went firstly to La Salle, and then on to St. Hippolyte de Fort, where we grouped up for a little bit, while some Germans were chased out of the area. Just little groups, you know, two or three of them. Mackie had great fun in shooting them up. And I had my best radio office of the campaign there. It was in the wall of an old castle that had been converted before the war into basic living quarters, and this particular room in, let back into it, had been the holiday home of a British clergyman and had electricity. What is more, it had a bulb, which was unheard of thing in that part of France. And I also got excellent radio transmission from there. That to me was a little bit of a holiday, if you like. From St. Hippolyte de Four, we, along with all the other going from La Salle to St. Hippolyte de Four, I also had a little bit of a contretemps. I had a little Fiat 500 car to carry all my gear, and it just about staggered along, and I missed the road. It was because as I went through the beginning of La Salle, all the people were standing on the pavements cheering, and I missed the people who told me to go off. And I ended up in another village about 10 miles away, near the main Rue 9, down the Rhone Valley. And the people there couldn't believe that I was British. They thought I was a German infiltrating them or trying to escape or something or the other, and they were going to do things to me, shoot me. Then they went and got some Mackie people, but they unfortunately were from the communist Mackie, and they had no doubts about it at all. They were going to take me out and hang me. Fortunately, with all the argy-bargy going on, suddenly a lad came into the village in the car. It was from our Mackie, and he was the son of one of the local people there. He said, "Oh no, he's our British sergeant, etc." And as the Fiat by now conked out, he towed me back to La Salle. So we were all right then. Then from St. Hippolyte de Four, we went down to Nîmes, where all the Mackie were congregating, to wind up our efforts with them.